Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How serious is the world's oil crisis, and does the U.S. have any hopes of getting through it with our economy and our environment intact? Last week, President Bush lifted an executive order put in place by George H.W. Bush that banned offshore oil drilling for nearly 20 years. The new order won't have much impact unless Congress lifts a similar prohibition, but should it? Would offshore drilling ease fuel prices even in the long term? Would it discourage American innovators from developing more fuel-efficient technologies? Would it threaten our environment and our ability to harvest fish from offshore waters? And why does offshore drilling matter when existing permits for drilling on land are going unused? Joining us to offer some perspective on these questions is Max Schultz. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute's Center for Energy Policy and the Environment. Max, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Great, thank you. Your position is that public energy policy in this country, and public opinion in some cases, tends to be grounded on myths rather than facts, one of which is that most of our oil comes from the Middle East. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Just so your listeners have some perspective on my background, I am at the Manhattan Institute. Before that, I was in the Bush administration, served at the Energy Department for 4.5 years. One of the things that struck me during that time was the degree of energy and environmental illiteracy, if you will, not just among the public at large, but even on Capitol Hill, certainly among the media. And that's one of the things that I've been kind of working on at the Manhattan Institute is to address these questions and point out the areas where there's kind of fundamental misperceptions about what our energy and environmental realities are. And one of those, is, as you mentioned a moment ago, is this idea that we are that we're beholden to the Middle East, that we get most of our oil from OPEC and from Saudi Arabia. If you ask the man on the street, he's going to tell you that's where we get our oil from. In fact, we actually asked the man on the street. We commissioned a poll from Zogby to ask 1,000 average Americans, a variety of these energy and environmental questions. One of which was, where do we get our energy from? Most folks think and believe, in part because of what we hear on the nightly news, that we get our oil from the Middle East by and large. But the reality is actually quite a bit different. We use a lot of oil in this country. We use somewhere on the order of about 20 million barrels of oil a day for our cars, our trucks. We use petroleum for other products as well. We use a lot.
About a quarter of the world's supply. Is that
about a quarter of the world's supply? Yes. And but the reality is, for all the talk about the OPEC in the Middle East, we largely get our oil that we use from North America. We get it from three primary sources. The first and the biggest supplier of oil to the United States is actually the United States. We don't think of ourselves often as one of the world's largest oil producers, but we are. We're an oil giant. We never think of ourselves this way, but we are. And the largest share of the oil we use in the United States is domestically produced, about 40%. Our biggest foreign supplier of oil is Canada. Our second biggest foreign supplier of oil after Canada is Mexico. And if you count North America, I think it's something on the order of 70% of our oil comes from these three countries, fairly stable part of the world, which I think gives some perspective to, I think, some of the overheated commentary we have about the degree to which we're beholden to OPEC. Now, OPEC certainly wields some power in pricing power in international oil markets. I don't think that they wield as much influence and power as they might have, say, 30 years ago.
So is it realistic to imagine that the United States might become, if not energy independent, maybe energy independent in North America?
Well, I think energy independence is almost the wrong way to look at things. In theory, we could become energy independent, meaning we produced all of the energy that we end up consuming, we produce it domestically. It wouldn't make very much difference, to be honest with you, because we operate in a global market. Even though I talk about how we get 70% of our oil from Canada and Mexico, and these are stable suppliers, and the United States, say, is stable suppliers, it doesn't make all that much difference in the grand scheme of things. What is important is to emphasize and focus on attaining measures of energy security. so that we're not overly dependent on one supplier, so that there are a variety of both suppliers and consumers in the market offering a degree of stability. 30 years ago, during the tensions with the Saudi Arabia and the Arab countries, we were a little more dependent on the Middle East, and they had a lot more power in terms of being one of the world's dominant suppliers. It's been dissipated over these last several decades because so many other nations are producing large volumes of oil, and that has dissipated their influence, which is ultimately a good thing.
Having worked in the Bush administration on energy policy, do you agree with the president that we are addicted to oil?
No, in fact, I'm actually rather glad that I left the administration several weeks before he made that pronouncement in the State of the Union address a couple of years ago. I don't agree with that statement for a number of reasons. We use a lot of oil. It is a major component of our energy economy. It is the dominant component of our transportation sector. But addiction is I think the wrong terminology. It connotes something I think fairly negative. It's something to be ashamed of, something that we should be embarrassed about. We do use lots of oil, but the things we use it for are the things which make us an extraordinarily prosperous country, things which expand our personal liberty. We are the wealthiest nation on the face of the earth, in large part because of our heavy use of oil, and that is ultimately a good thing. I think that to say that you're addicted to oil is not all that different from saying that you're addicted to prosperity, and we are a prosperous nation, and we can thank our oil use for that. Should we try to find ways to shore up the security of our energy sector and our economy? Absolutely. I don't dispute that, but the phraseology that we're addicted to oil, I think, was very unfortunate on the president's part, and I think that it's one of these lines which is good. He's going to be remembered for, and I think it is very unfortunate, and I have to say, as someone who worked in his administration and agreed with many of his, and still do agree with many of his energy proposals, that's one that I can't get on board with.
By almost all accounts, though, Max, there is a finite supply of oil on the planet, and there are different conjectures as to how long it will last at the current rates of consumption. But what do you think about alternative technologies, and should we be moving away from oil, if not from energy dependence?
Well, I mean, I think alternative technologies are great. I'd like to see one. Both the federal government and the private sector have been looking for alternatives to the internal combustion engine and alternatives to oil for a while. We haven't really come up with anything satisfactory yet, which speaks to how good oil and how good the internal combustion engine have been, how efficient they are. They are, frankly, as economical as it comes in terms of anything we've seen. Which is one of the reasons they are still around. I think that moving towards alternative energies is a fine thing, and I guess I support the federal government continuing its research in these efforts in hopes of finding some sort of breakthrough. I'm not putting much stock in any sort of grand breakthrough which is going to overthrow the internal combustion engine and our use of oil anytime soon. But I do want to make one larger point about that, because the president said in his speech when he said that we're addicted to oil, he also said we need to move beyond the petroleum-based economy. The fact is, and it's one of the kind of little-known economic or little-acknowledged stories about our economy, is that the trends have shown over the last several decades that we are indeed moving beyond the petroleum-based economy. Petroleum is still a big part of our economy, but today it really only underpins our transportation sector. It is not used to generate electricity anymore. It used to generate fairly high volumes. Back in the early 1970s, it was a fairly high percentage. Now it's negligible. All the economic growth we've seen in this country in the last 2.5 decades, and we've seen a tremendous increase in our gross domestic product, of virtually all of that economic growth, something on the order of 85% of our economic growth over the time, has been fueled by businesses and industries that rely primarily on electricity and the fuels that produce electricity rather than petroleum. So So our economy every year is increasingly electrifying, and which is a positive thing for our energy security because we have so many different things, coal, nuclear, natural gas, even renewables to an extent, that generate electricity. And every year, oil and petroleum is becoming, you know, less and less important in our energy economy. Now, it still is important, certainly, but it's you know, less and less important each year, and certainly less important than it was back during the energy scares of the 1970s.
Max Schultz is my guest. He's a senior fellow for energy policy and the environment at the Manhattan Institute. We are talking today about energy policy in the United States. Let's talk about these industries that operate on electricity. The chief source of electrical power in this country is coal, if I'm not mistaken.
It is, yes. It gives us about, on average, about half of America's electricity comes from coal.
And even clean-burning coal technologies, which is not what is being utilized in the majority of U.S. coal plants, but they carry a pretty heavy environmental price.
Sure, it's they do. I mean, coal is a relatively dirty fuel. It also is capable of producing huge quantities of baseload electrical power. So that's the trade-off. You get cheap and relatively efficient power. In turn, you have environmental considerations that you have to deal with. We have technologies like wind and solar and some other renewables, which certainly don't generate emissions on the scale that coal does, but they also can't generate electricity on the scale and in the reliable way that coal does.
Is that because there's not enough infrastructure right now?
No, I don't think it's an infrastructure problem. And I think it's one of fundamental economics. It's a lump of coal, that contains quite a bit of energy. To generate the volumes of electricity that you would need from a coal plant, for instance, if you want to do that with wind turbines, you'd have to take a huge area to equal the amount of electricity that you're going to get from a relatively small coal plant. Nuclear power, a gram of uranium is going to contain more power than even a trainload of coal. It's you have to take a look at the punch these energy technologies pack. So I don't think it's an infrastructure question. I don't even think it's an investment question. The government, federal government, and state governments too, particularly in places like California, have been investing heavily in research for renewables like wind and solar for many, many years. Direct subsidies for research, tax credits, things like that, and yet they've failed to take any sort of a foothold in our energy economy. We talked a moment ago about how coal produces half of America's electricity. Wind mills and solar panels, all told, even after huge government subsidies for decades, produce, I think it's 1/5 of 1% of our electricity. It's hard to even call it a marginal part of our energy economy. It's an almost negligible part. They're poised for growth. Windmills are getting more efficient slightly. Solar panels are getting better at producing electricity, but even if they have massive growth in those sectors, which we may have, I'm optimistic that we will, they still will only comprise a couple percentage points of our electrical generation in a couple decades. It's great to have their contributions to our energy economy, but they're not any sort of energy salvation.
Max Schultz is my guest. He's Senior Fellow for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute. We'll continue our conversation after the break and would love to have you join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a senior fellow for energy policy and the environment at the Manhattan Institute. He also worked in the energy department in the Bush administration. His name is Max Schultz. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Max, before the break, you were talking about the fact that we've had huge government subsidies for alternative fuel technologies, things like wind and solar power, for decades, and not that much has come from those in terms of the percentage of energy generated by these technologies. I'm wondering, though, we've had these subsidies for decades, but we've only had a sort of universal understanding of the problems of global warming for a couple of years now. We've only had $145 oil for a couple of weeks or months at this point. Do you think that there is now a greater incentive that will actually yield more from researching these alternative technologies now?
Well, I think I don't know. I'm not so sure. Just because there's such grave economic limitations that appear inherent in some of these technologies, I think that if your concern is to be able to produce much greater amounts of electricity in a manner that doesn't produce greenhouse gas emissions, then I think it would be more important to focus on an expansion of nuclear power in this country than an expansion of wind and solar. As I said, I think wind and solar can contribute a small, marginal portion of our nation's electricity, but it's not going to be capable, really, of substituting for the much larger share that we now get from fossil fuels.
What will change in this country if Congress lifts its ban on offshore drilling?
Well, I think that what will change in this country is a very good question. I think that we have to look at it in respect to the rise in oil prices over the last decade. As I mentioned, I think we use about 80 to 85 million barrels a day is what the world consumes of oil every day. A growing percentage of that comes from demand in developing countries like China and India and other parts of the world, which is, at the end of the day, frankly, a very positive development. Our economy has actually been strong, basically for the last quarter century and certainly for the last decade, and oil demand has been steady and has been growing in this country as a result. So we've seen an upward tick in demand, but we haven't seen a commensurate upward tick in available supply. Supplies have been growing worldwide, and energy companies are trying all over the world to expand supply to the degree that they can, with a few exceptions in the Middle East, where OPEC countries are committed in principle to limiting their production. But otherwise, we've seen a narrowing in the margin between the supplies that are available and demand that is available in recent years. At times, there's been a spread of on a given day of you know, maybe 2-3 million barrels a day available. That has contributed to the rise in the price of oil in a big way. If we were to open for exploration and development, the reserves that we have in, say, in Anwar, in Alaska, or off the Outer Continental Shelf, and areas of the Gulf of Mexico, which are presently off limits, and we're able to contribute an extra couple million barrels a day to the global economy, I think it would significantly ease prices. I think that is the great effect that we would see. We wouldn't see it overnight, certainly, because it would take quite a bit of time to get these. To get that oil to the market, but over time it ought to ease prices.
If in fact it did ease prices, should we worry that there's less incentive to create alternative technologies that are more fuel efficient, and there's no incentive for people to conserve energy?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, it's if your interest is in getting us off oil as quickly as possible, I think people then those folks should be celebrating the run up in prices in recent years. It certainly has turned some people's attention to creating alternative technologies. I'm probably not as worried as most about that, but it is funny that we've seen folks in some folks in Congress, particularly Democrats, over the last couple decades, who've been saying, you know, for a variety of reasons, that we need to get off oil, calling for taxes on energy to raise the price to get people to use less and to think about going in alternative directions. And then when market forces have conspired to push the price of energy much higher, many of these same people have been the first to complain about the high prices. You know, we have seen the effect of these high prices on consumption to a degree in recent months particularly. We've seen people cutting back a bit in their oil and gasoline consumption, and arguably that's a good thing. You know, people do respond to incentives, and you know, one of those responses is thinking about pursuing new technologies and new fuels. Another incentive is also to think about boosting production.
Max Schultz is with us. He's from the Manhattan Institute. You can find them online at manhattan-institute.org. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Dan in Dallas. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. I'm glad you got this topic on. Great show. I'm going to have to call our speaker, Max, out on a couple of things that he mentioned. The first thing that he called America an oil giant, and we only have about 2.3% of the world's petroleum, so I'd kind of like to hear why he would call us an oil giant. And secondly, on the subsidies that he mentioned, or that you mentioned for him, I think, for renewables as being, you know, huge, I think the amount for, if you looked at the amount for nuclear, for example, the amount of subsidies since the 1940s, if that's like $1,000, I mean, the amount for renewables has been about $11. So I'd like to get those comments. Thank you very much. I'll take it off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Interesting points. I'm not I forget exactly what the percentage of the oil reserves in the ground that the United States has, but in terms of production, I think we're the third or the fourth largest producer of oil every day. Furthermore, we know that we have billions of barrels of oil locked away in federal lands up in Alaska and the Outer Continental Shelf, and those are just kind of conventional reserves of oil. We have several trillion barrels, I believe, of oil equivalent in the oil shale in Colorado. So we are a major, major producer of oil, and I think that's an incontrovertible fact. But because we are such a giant consumer of oil, and we consume more than even we are capable of producing, we tend to think of ourselves not so much as a producer, but as a consumer who's kind of, you know, goes hat in hand to OPEC and to the other nations that produce oil. An interesting point about subsidies for nuclear power. There's no question that the nuclear industry has enjoyed to some degree some subsidies and protections from government over years. The commercial nuclear power industry obviously grows out of the federal government's experiment to create a nuclear weapon to help win the Second World War. But having said that, I mean, the question is how you define your subsidies. When you look at nuclear power, nuclear power plant that is standing alone generates electricity so much more cheaply and so much more efficiently and so much more reliably than just about any other technology. Now, I too have questions with how the federal government, with the federal government's relations in how we have financed nuclear plant construction over the years, and may continue to do so. I think it is, you know, just, you know, side by side comparisons of renewable energies, wind and solar and biomass and things like that, compared to nuclear power, show that the nuclear is far more efficient and far more reliable than those technologies.
If you could redistribute the places where we get energy, let's talk about electricity in this country. I assume that you would use more nuclear power than anything else.
I would certainly increase its share. I mean, it's right now we get about 20% of our electricity from nuclear power, and it differs from state to state. California gets I think a smaller percentage. Some states get very big percentages. Texas, I think, has one nuclear power plant with possible plans for another. But you know, let's look at that at the distribution. Coal gives us 50%. Nuclear gives us 20%. Natural gas gives us another 20%. Large-scale hydropower, dams like the Hoover Dam and the Grand Coulee Dam, gives us, I think, about 6%. And the rest is a mix of you know, things like oil, which is 1 or 2%, I think, and a host of renewable energies. If I could do anything, I would try to lessen considerably the use of natural gas in our electricity generating mix. Natural gas burns cleanly. It's about twice, I was about to say twice as clean as coal, but maybe a better way to say it is half as dirty as coal. But the problem with natural gas is that it is, the price has been extraordinarily volatile in recent years. It is extremely expensive now. It's five times what it was several years ago. Natural gas is used for other things in our economy as well, and has put price pressure in those areas, in agriculture and manufacturing and whatnot. But I think that if we wanted natural gas is also the only one of these fuels which at present could make a good kind of direct fuel for our transportation sector. And I think that we should start to try to think about displacing our natural gas use in the electricity sector, so that we can move some of that over to the transportation sector.
Excuse me for interrupting. Even with such a volatile price that we've seen over the past few years,
such a volatile price, yes. But primarily also just to get it out of the electricity sector. It has helped drive up electricity prices in a number of places in recent years because of the volatility of the price of natural gas. The price of for nuclear power, for instance, the price of uranium has gone up considerably in the last couple of years. But that is such a small part of the cost of generating electricity from nuclear power that it's almost an afterthought. It hasn't had any real effect on the price of electricity from nuclear power, because the price for nuclear power is really an upfront cost, the capital cost of construction for a plant, for instance. Once you get a plant built, you need such a small amount of uranium to generate electricity that the price of it is almost inconsequential.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Max Schultz. He's Senior Fellow for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute. Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, good afternoon, Chris and Max. Hey, I think I misheard or might have misheard one of your opening comments. Max, did you say that our top two providers to the United States are Canada and Mexico?
Yes.
I'm looking at the July 14th Newsweek, and it says Saudi Arabia is second behind Canada at 1.5 billion barrels a day.
I don't have that in front of me. I'm going after from the Energy Information Administration statistics. I'm certain that Canada is a much larger supplier of our oil, and so is Mexico to the United States than Saudi Arabia.
So does it vary at points?
It varies a little bit from time to time. A couple of months go by, and one country may be selling us slightly less and one country slightly more. But generally, the way it's been for decades has been Canada, then Mexico, then I think Venezuela has been our third major supplier. All told, I think that the Middle Eastern countries provide about 12% of our of America's oil, about one out of every eight barrels. All told, OPEC, and so we're going to include Nigeria and Venezuela. OPEC provides about 20%, all told.
Of course, our relationship politically with Venezuela has not been particularly good over the past few years.
No, it hasn't.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Lisa in Lancaster. Hi, Lisa.
Yes, good afternoon. Your guest mentioned Alaska. I have a question, please. I understand the Alaska crude has a very high sulfur content and cannot be processed in the United States or any of the refining installations that they have here. My question is, where is it going? Is it going across the Pacific to be refined somewhere else and then shipped back for usage in the United States? Or it doesn't sound cost-effective to me. I would like to know where the Alaska crude is going. And what's the point in drilling up there if it can't be used for your national usage here? And what's the point in drilling in Anwar? So that's my question, and I'll hang up.
Thanks for your call.
It's a good question from Lisa. I think that the I'm not sure if that's entirely true. I think some of that crude is capable of being refined at some of the West Coast refineries, although it is very difficult, and we have a lot of problems with our refining capabilities in this country. But I believe a lot of it is actually shipped to Alaska. To Japan, which like the United States, imports a great deal of the oil that it uses. But the point is, even if 100% of the oil from Alaska ends up being refined and those products sold overseas, it doesn't make that much of a difference. It wouldn't make any difference compared to if we refined it all in the United States. Because the point is, we do operate in a global market. It's, you know, the best way to think of it maybe is to think of a kind of a giant bathtub full of oil, with all the nations, all the consuming nations of the world drawing from it, and all the producing nations pouring into it. And so that has a stabilizing effect on prices, and that the prices are the same all over the world. And so all in all, it doesn't make any difference, you know, where it's sold and where it's consumed. You know, a lot of people tend to think, you know, if you think back about the Arab oil embargoes, the 1970s, the early 70s, people tend to think that there was that it had a real grave effect on the U.S. economy, but it actually didn't really have any effect at all, and it backfired on the Saudis. They tried to stop selling oil only to the United States and only to, I think, Norway was the other country. They tried to single us out. But it didn't work. We were still able to get oil. What it did was it had an effect on the global market as a whole. Prices went up all over the world. We were still able to buy oil. It was more expensive, but it was more expensive for everyone around the world. It ultimately did. You know, that sort of oil imperialism doesn't work. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, the leaders of Iran occasionally try to cut us off. But they can't really without cutting off sales all over the world.
Max Schultz is my guest. He's Senior Fellow for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Senior Fellow for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute, Max Schultz. You can find his work online at manhattan-institute.org. If you want to join our conversation about U.S. energy policy today, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Max, is it reasonable, do you think, to ask Americans to consume less energy than they currently are?
I don't know if it's reasonable or not. I mean, I think it would be a fruitless enterprise. Conservation is one of these wonderful ideas. It sounds great, but historically, our experience is that it doesn't happen. Historically, we you know, as we grow more prosperous, we consume more energy. That has been the historical trend. I don't see too much reason for it to stop. You know, I think that our energy consumption is actually a pretty good proxy for our economic productivity. And if we want people to consume less, they're probably going to ultimately produce less. In our personal lives, limiting our consumption, or, you know, minimizing it to the degree we can, is fine. Becoming more efficient is wonderful. But as the cornerstones of national policy, I'm not so sure it would be too successful.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Charlie in Lakewood. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Max, reference to potential uranium supply problems. Are breeder reactors finally a viable alternative for electricity production in the United States?
I think they are certainly something which could contribute to our mix. And there are a number of different nuclear technologies and types of reactors that could help out. Breeder reactors are just one type. You know, we have a number of kind of exciting types of nuclear reactors which are kind of on the drawing boards. One, for instance, is a pebble bed reactor, which is being pioneered largely by the Chinese and the South Africans, but it's kind of a smaller reactor which uses these uranium pellets about the size of baseballs, which when they are used up, they pose no nuclear waste problems or proliferation problems. Our mindset in this country when it comes to nuclear power is often just to think about Three Mile Island and kind of stop thinking there, when in fact around the world nuclear technologies have progressed considerably in the three decades since Three Mile Island. Think about the difference between our cars from the 1970s and our cars today, or our toasters or televisions or anything. And our nuclear technologies are quite a bit more advanced than they were several decades ago.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Jimmy in Dallas. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. This is really eye-opening for me. I've been hearing talk about speculators and their impact on the cost of fuels as much as 30%. Max, what is your real take, and what is the real truth about speculators, and do we deserve to point the finger at them, or 50 lashes with a wet noodle, or what's the real deal with that? I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks.
Sure. Speculators are they're certainly the folks being demonized this week for the run-up in oil prices. And personally, I think that the run-up in oil prices has much more to do with our weak dollar policy and the supply and demand fundamentals that I talked about a little bit ago. Speculators, I can't get on board with this idea that speculators are these great villains. They're traders. They're folks who are to a large degree, a lot of them are folks who are trying to hedge risk. They're big consumers of energy, whether they're airlines or refineries who are trying to lock in prices in the future because they think they're going to go higher. And on the flip side of it, there are a lot of speculators who think the price is going to go lower. For every option that's sold, for someone who says the price is going to go higher, and the theory is that these folks are creating a bubble by driving up the price of oil. For every one of those people, someone has to be on the other end to take that bet to say that the prices are going to go lower. So I don't exactly buy this idea that speculators being the villains. They're not the ones who are taking possession of oil and therefore to kind of keep it off the market. Speculators are traders who perform a fairly important role in the economy in terms of managing risk.
I guess by and large, though, individual consumers don't have the option of speculating on the fuel that they purchase.
True. That's true. In some limited capabilities dealing with our natural gas providers in some locations, we can do that. But for the most part, you're right. We don't have those those choices in a lot of cases.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Ricardo in Dallas. Hi, Ricardo.
Hello. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure.
And I have a short question. In business or in school, they teach us to increase shareholder value. How can this philosophy be influencing our need for energy in this country? Could we decrease the needs for energy in producing so many cars? And like your guest said, we would have to decrease production. Exactly. Well, I think that's what we have to do, decrease production to reduce our needs for energy. And that's my question. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I have to confess, I didn't exactly hear everything said. Chris, would you tell
me? I think what he meant was if we made fewer automobiles and there were fewer technologies, I think, produced to that would demand fuel, would that make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting in our energy economy is what is happening in transportation. We despair over what the president said, this addiction to oil, which obviously underpins our transportation economy. But I talked a little bit ago about the electrification of our economy, and I do think that it's something which is going to continue and cross over into the transportation sector over the next decade and a half. We've seen, in terms of our technological developments, we've seen some real kind of revolutions in our automotive technologies. If you think about, you know, look at the dashboard of your car the next time you get in it. Unless you're driving something from 20 years ago, you're looking at you know, something which is at LED displays and computers. We're driving cars which much of them in the upfront area are very big computers. That wasn't the case in the 1970s. As transistors and microprocessors allow us to improve our automobiles, we're going to be able to displace you know, much of the manual mechanics in the engines of cars with computerized with computers, and that is going to have a big effect on the weight of cars in the future. So cars will you know, require less oil to move them. We're also going to see the rise of hybrids, which can run on electricity, you know, particularly for short trips, which make up the bulk of our trips, you know, in-town trips. You know, plug-in hybrids, which are going to also displace quite a bit of our oil consumption. I think those are positive developments. Those are things which are happening not because the government has been dictating it. It has, you know, very little to do with CAFE standards that increase fuel efficiency. It's happening because consumers generally want it, and because it's you know, a mark of the kind of technological process progress that we've seen in the you know, computer and microchip revolution.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Hannah in Dallas. Hi, Hannah.
Hello. As a consumer, a simple person that doesn't have that much information, I just see profits from oil companies, billionaire profits from oil companies, and then I see the price rising for us consumers. So a simple-minded person just adds up 2 + 2, and why the government is not limiting the earnings of big oil companies to provide for a better price for us consumers.
What do you think about that, Max?
Well, I think that I understand, you know, people look at the board of the service station and see $4-$4.50 gasoline, and then they, you know, hear that you know, ExxonMobil is reaping big profits each quarter. But I would say that a couple things. One, people fail to realize the taxes that the oil majors pay to the federal government. They pay billions and billions and billions of dollars. The federal government has done, you know, quite well by the run-up in gas prices. But I would also say, you know, the implicit in Hannah's comment is this idea that the quote big oil companies are somehow manipulating the price of oil and have the market by the short hairs. When in fact the one of the kind of ironies of the global marketplace is that the big oil companies, which are indeed very large companies, actually are fairly small fry when it comes to the size and scope of the world oil market. You know, we think of ExxonMobil, which is the biggest, you know, publicly held company in America. We think of it as this absolute corporate giant, and Chevron and Shell and BP. These are very, very large companies, and they have been making very large profits in recent years. But in fact, as I said, they're kind of small fry when it comes to the global oil market. They're actually not the biggest oil companies in the world. The biggest oil companies in the world are the state-owned oil companies in Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and China, Nigeria, these places. If you were to put them all together, ExxonMobil, which is the biggest of the publicly held, you know, a.k.a. private investor-owned oil companies, would rank something like 16th largest oil company in the world. And the big oil companies, which are the ones that get demonized at our congressional hearings and on the nightly news, the big oil companies control, all in all, just 6% of the world's oil resources. Well, you know, while that is enough to make them a lot of money, it is not enough for them in any way to manipulate prices. About 10 years ago, the price of a barrel of oil was around $10 a barrel, which is not enough for any of these companies to be making too much money. And if these guys if they had the power to manipulate the price of oil, they certainly would have done it at the time. There's no question they've profited handsomely from the run-up in prices in recent years. I would say that to a large degree, they have profited because they made smart bets to drill in a variety of areas, to search for oil in a variety of areas. Many of these bets were made 10 years ago or longer ago because the production cycle is such a long one. Big investments, billion-dollar investments, were made long ago when no one knew the price of oil was ever going to get up to $140 a barrel. A lot of these investments were made when oil was $10 a barrel, and shareholders, rightly could have asked, is it worth it to be pouring billions of dollars into such projects when oil is selling for $10 a barrel now? These companies are companies which have very long-term perspectives on the market. I think that they all generally feel that the price of oil is going to be coming down in a few years. They're not in the business of manipulating the prices we pay. They have been the beneficiaries, almost certainly. There's no question about it. They've been the beneficiaries of the circumstances of the last few years, some of which are kind of politically derived to circumstances. I wish I owned stock in ExxonMobil or any of these companies. I don't. They've paid handsome dividends the last few years. At the end of the day, my inclination is to say more power to you guys. You guys made your investments, you made your bets years ago, and they've paid off. In terms of whether we should seize the profits of oil companies and put them to other uses, we seize a lot of the money that the oil companies bring in the form of taxes. I think ExxonMobil is the biggest corporate taxpayer in America, so the government is getting its share and it puts it to whatever it wants, and it invests in a lot of renewable technologies and these things. So in some respects, we're already doing what Hannah proposed.
So in the 30 seconds or so that we have left, Max, what would you say is the most pressing concern when it comes to American energy production and consumption today?
Let me broaden the question a little bit and ask what our biggest concern ought to be. And I'm going to say something which is probably surprising. I think that for all the talk of oil and its importance, and there's certainly very important economic and geopolitical and environmental issues, I would say that the most important thing that we can do in terms of advancing our energy policy and our energy security in this country is to get our electricity issues right, to get our grid prepared to handle 21st century loads. We didn't really touch on these issues so much today, but ultimately those are going to be more important in the 21st century than our oil questions.
You can read more of Max Schultz's work at the Manhattan Institute at manhattan-institute.org. He is senior fellow there at the Center for Energy Policy and the Environment. Max, very interesting hour. Thanks so much for joining us.
Chris, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.